Henry, one of my heroes. Congratulations on your Shining World Compassion Award. You are a very good and devoted human being. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Take care. Bye-bye.
Peace.
Hiring a development director. This 32-hour-a-week position develops and implements the yearly fundraising plan, develops promotional and press materials, and supports the anti-oppression work of KABU. Send a cover letter and resume to Delphine Crescenzo at del@kabu.org or send to KABU Development Hire, 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon 97214. Please answer in the cover letter the question, why is KABU important? Deadline to apply is Sunday, November 25th at midnight. More information on the development director position is available at kabu.fm/developmenthire2018.
It's coming. It's almost here.
It's the next GiveGuard Big Give Day, Thursday, November 15th. There's no wrong time to give to KABU. KABU has real people making live radio all day, every day.
But when you give to KABU in the Give Guide this Thursday, November 15th, you'll be entered into a raffle to win a Tender Loving Empire vinyl package, plus a year's worth of Laughing Planet.
If you're 35 or under, you'll also be entered into another raffle for a second gift package.
Go to kboo.fm/give on Thursday, November 15th to contribute.
That's kboo.fm/give this Thursday for your chance to win.
Support KABU,
where music makes the movement. Tune in
and turn up.
KBOO Portland.
Flashpoints, over a dozen people arrested fighting to protect the people's right to...
KBOO Portland.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is novelist R.O. Kwan, a graduate of Yale and the MFA program at Brooklyn College. Kwan's writing has appeared in Tin House, Vice, Noon, The Believer, The Guardian, New York Magazine, and elsewhere. She's a National Endowment for the Arts Literature Fellow, was a 2014 Steinbeck Fellow at the Martha Heasley Cox Center, and has been named one of narrative's 30 Below 30 writers. She's also the author of one of the most buzzed about and critically acclaimed books of 2018, The Incendiaries, out with Riverhead Books. Lauren Groff calls The Incendiaries a God-haunted, willful, strange book written with a kind of savage elegance. The Paris Review says every page of The Incendiaries blooms with sensuous language. The New Yorker says, with a fairy tale quality reminiscent of Donna Tartt's The Secret History, The Incendiaries is the rare depiction of belief that doesn't kill the thing it aspires to by trying too hard. It makes a space and then steps away to let the mystery in. Anthony Domestico says in Common Wheel, in strikingly Augustinian fashion, Kwan returns again and again to how the true motor of faith is desire, desire for meaning, beauty, healing, peace. She also shows how this desire continues, perhaps even more powerfully, once faith has left us. And Viet Thanh Nguyen adds, every explosive requires a fuse. That's R.O. Kwan's novel, a straight, slow-burning fuse. To read her novel is to follow an inexorable flame, coming closer and closer to the object it will detonate, the characters, the crime, the story, and ultimately, the reader. Welcome to Between the Covers, R.O. Kwan.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Toni Morrison has a quote, "If there's a book you really want to read, but it hasn't been written yet, then you must write it." And it seems like you've sort of taken this advice to heart. You've said in many interviews that the portrayal of the loss of faith is something that is hard to find in literature, and that this, what you describe as a God-shaped hole in your own life from this loss of faith, the absence that your life orbits around, is not something that you've recognized in what you've read. And I was curious if there are books, however imperfect, that were addressing faith, maybe not satisfactorily, that sort of prompted this desire, or were you really in uncharted waters when you started writing The Incendiaries and write the thing that you didn't see?
That's a great question. I think when I've talked about not having found literature that grappled with faith and the loss of faith and having questions of faith, that was more when I was 17 and hadn't come across and hadn't read quite as broadly. Since then, I've come across more of it. It's still not like the most explored of subjects in fiction, but I love what Graham Greene writes about faith. I love James Wood has written really movingly about his own experiences with faith. Let's see, there are other ways in which there are a lot of glimpses. Anya Carson has written gorgeously about her experiences with belief and her, and the ways in which she approaches it. I love Simone Veil. She believed, but even so, the ways in which she believed are I find to be very recognizable and moving. I'm missing a bunch of people, but I love what Clarissa Spector says about the idea of God and notions of God. There are more.
That's a pretty good list, actually. So the book looks at faith through three lenses. That of Will, a college-age boy who's lost his faith. And then we have his girlfriend, Phoebe, who may be finding hers, and the cult leader, John Leal, who has created a community that has sort of captivated Phoebe's imagination. But given how much you've spoken about how your own biography has been the fuel for this examination of what it means to believe and then to have belief disappear, could we start with a look at of your life of faith, what it looked like for you growing up in your family?
Yeah, of course. So I was raised Catholic. My family's still deeply Catholic. And then when I was in junior high school, I started veering off into more sort of off-brand, ecstatic kinds of Protestantism. Sort of what you would imagine with people talking in tongues and falling to the ground and dancing and singing. And I think part of it is that that's the kind of Christianity that most of my friends were involved in. And also, it was just so fun, you know? It brought me into regular communion with the ecstatic in a way that growing up in a small town outside of LA wasn't necessarily always available. I became increasingly religious. I believed that I would become a missionary or a pastor. And then when I was 17, I lost the faith. And since then, I've been out of the fold.
So the pivoting from your family's Catholicism to this branch of Protestantism was based on something more to do with your own community of friends that you were with?
Yeah, and it wasn't, for me at least, it wasn't mutually exclusive. I was still going to Mass with my family, and then I would, on Friday night, go to youth rallies with my friends, and Wednesdays, and Saturdays.
But it sounded like it had some really, at the time at least, very positive effects. Like you've described how you didn't have anxiety, for instance.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say I had no anxiety, but I was a much less anxious animal than I am now. Because I did believe that, or I wanted to believe at least when I couldn't necessarily believe, I more or less believed that there was an omnipotent being who was watching over everything, would make everything all right, and that there was no death, and I would never lose anyone I loved. And that was such a different way to live than how I live now.
Yeah, and the branch that you went into was different enough from Catholicism that your family was concerned that it might have been a cult, even though you didn't consider it one and it wasn't considered one?
It wasn't the branch itself. It was just one of the churches that I would visit with my friends. What had a youth group that was absorbing enough that my parents were a little worried. A lot of parents were a little worried, but it really wasn't. It was just more able to keep more of our attention, I'd say, than some of the other youth groups.
I would love to talk about cults, and specifically the cult in the Incendiaries. I would love to start with John Leal, the cult leader. You said you did a lot of research on cults, but then ultimately abandoned a lot of the research because you wanted the cult that you created in the book to sort of stand on its own terms. So I was hoping maybe we could start with a description of the personal mythology of John Leal's past that is so compelling to people.
The story that he tells his followers is that he went off to Yanji in China, which is a border town, and where, in fact, there are a lot of, that is where a lot of refugees end up because there's a river between China and North Korea. And when it's frozen, you can cross it, and it's a nexus for a lot of refugees and a lot of people who want to help refugees. The story that he tells is that he went there and he was helping refugees and that he was kidnapped and taken across the border to North Korean gulag, where he stayed for some months and then was brought back to the border and just told to cross back. And I think he paints himself as a hero, and a kind of outsized hero, in a way that I think his followers end up finding to be very appealing.
So can you tell us a little bit about some of the rituals and activities that are created in his group that, if you become a member, become part of your existence and part of your daily activities when you're in the group?
At first, it seems like not much, you know. For a while, they really do sit around studying the Bible, listening to music, eating together. And then it's only after a while that the activities start intensifying. And there are physical rituals that he asks of his followers. I haven't described this to anyone before, so I'm trying to think about how to describe it without, because I know people get so mad about spoilers.
Well, one of the things that comes to mind to me is the digging of a hole and then the filling of it back up.
Yeah.
I mean, even though that it doesn't serve any like utilitarian purpose, in a way it sort of does in terms of community building, because mm-hmm. they get this task and then it almost feels like there's a meaninglessness to the task, but it's also sort of like a Zen koan in a sense, like mm-hmm. you're going to do this together mm-hmm. and then you're going to be in a different place.
Yeah, that's so lovely. And there's also something, I think, to that task of asking his followers to commit themselves over and over again to doing things that don't necessarily make sense to them.
When you were writing this book, did you do a lot of research about Christianity in Korea? Mm. Or did you already know a lot about the history of Christianity in Korea? Because I've always been curious why Christianity took such a hold in Korea compared to other countries in the region.
Yeah, I did do research into Christianity into Korea, less so than some of my research into cults or into radical groups and into the history of abortion rights, reproductive rights in America, just because Korea itself does play less of a role in the book. There's a variety of explanations for why Christianity did take a hold in Korea. I will say, though, that it still didn't take that much of a hold. I mean, I think the last time I saw the numbers, it's maybe 30% of Koreans are Christian, Korean Koreans in Korea. It's more like 80% in the U.S., Korean Americans.
But that's still pretty high, 30% in South Korea.
Yeah. Given it wasn't there at all at a certain point. But, I mean, there's a variety of reasons that I've read. One is that Christians got very involved in fighting against communists in South Korea. And so that was one way that they started attracting followers. Mm-hmm. They built a lot of schools that became appealing.
And the little bit that I was looking into, just out of my own curiosity and reading the book, was even in the 19th century, Pyongyang was considered the Jerusalem of the East because of the number of churches it had. I mean, they only, I think Korea was like 2% Christian at the time, but instead of 30% now, but still then there was some sort of something that was particularly Korean that wasn't happening in China or Japan.
And there are also ways in which, I mean, in Japan, they, from what I've read, I'm definitely not an expert on this. I mean, not that I'm an expert at all on Christianity in Korea, but from what I've read in Japan, they were very, very opposed to allowing Christians and Christianity into the country. But I did come across the number at some point, and I don't know if this is still true, but at least at a certain point, South Korea was sending more missionaries abroad than any country but the U.S. And that was in absolute numbers, not in relative numbers, which, wow, of course, is huge given South Korea is so small in terms of the size of its population.
Have you ever seen the movie Secret Sunshine?
No, I haven't.
By Lee Chang-dong. So the reason I thought of it is not only because it has a portrayal of Christianity in Korea, but also the main character goes through getting faith and then losing faith. But what is happening with that main character reminds me a little bit of what's happening with Phoebe and the Incendiaries, in the sense that the faith that the person gets in Secret Sunshine and loses is happening right after the death of someone very close to them. And it seems like with Phoebe, perhaps the fact that she's in mourning and that somebody very close to her has died and her life is destabilized, that maybe there's some connection between this vulnerability and this this openness to accepting faith. I was hoping you could talk to us maybe a little bit about Phoebe as a character, particularly the way you see, if you do, her mother's death being connected to somehow an attraction to John Leal's cult.
I think when people, I hesitate to generalize, but for my characters, and for me certainly, when these characters are grieving, when they're feeling pain, they become more open to change, perhaps, than people who are feeling relatively contented and relaxed and feel as though things are going pretty well. And so they become open to different kinds of answers to the questions that they might have. And Phoebe is in a great deal of pain when she comes to Knoxhurst, to the college town where much of the book is set. And that does make her more vulnerable to someone like John Leal.
Maybe you could read this one little section that I marked out on page 149.
Yeah, absolutely. It wasn't that Christianity fetishized pain or exalted it. What point could there be in glorifying something so available? It would be like exalting oxygen. But the faith did recognize the potential effect of pain, how it can, with most of us, open what's closed. Like cut flesh, we become available to excluded possibilities. Light enters in the injured place, he said, that the bones which he hath broken might rejoice.
We've been listening to R.O. Kwan read from The Incendiaries. So sort of as a mirror image to this quote, you said that your loss of faith was a devastating loss, one that causes enduring pain, and that there was no precipitating event, that it happened both suddenly and gradually, or gradually and then all of a sudden. But do you feel like the pain of the absence of faith also opens something that is closed, that it makes available excluded possibilities, or is it only unidirectional in that sense? Like when we talk about John Leal's twinning of pain and opportunity, essentially, what's your orientation to the loss of faith and the pain?
That's such an interesting question. No one's asked that. I will say, but this would be natural, or this would be obvious, perhaps. After I lost my faith, I did become a very different person, you know, just like from the top to the bottom of the kinds of things I believed. I probably would have, and this is so horrifying to me now, but I probably would have identified as a Republican in high school, and insofar as I really thought about it. And now, of course, I'm a you know, I couldn't possibly be more progressive, I think. And so there are the ways in which I've like very much changed in my values. Since losing my faith, I've learned to, and I try to take more joy. I've tried to find more value in ephemeral joys that I might not have appreciated as much when I believed that I would live forever. And to try to feel less grief about how fleeting they are.
You've mentioned also that reading played a role in you drifting from Christianity. Was it just reading in general, or were there like certain pivotal books that sort of cracked the system and broke it?
I love how you word that. It was just reading in general. It was just spending so very much time, because I loved reading. It was my favorite thing to do. Spending so much time in the heads of people who weren't like me and who didn't believe as I did, it just became increasingly difficult to believe that anyone who didn't believe what I believed about how the world worked was doomed to burn in hellfire.
And you've also said Anne Carson's Eros is where the novel began, and I was wondering how so.
I don't really know, and this breaks my heart. I was reading Eros and I was loving it, and I'm just like falling in love with Anne Carson. And I was in grad school, and I just remember I was like taking notes on, you know, I was just scribbling all over the page, taking notes all over. And there was something about that book and its focus on the Sappho fragment that she centers the book on, that meant a great deal to me, and about love and about not quite being able to have what you love. And anyway, but I lost that book because in a fit of drunken exuberance, I had a dear friend over, and I usually don't lend books that mean a lot to me for exactly this reason. I lent him this book because he hadn't read it yet, and then he lost it.
Is he still your friend?
We're still friends, but I haven't lent out books that mean a lot to me ever since, because I know that that's what happens with books you lend out. If you lend out a book, you have to assume it's a gift. Like it's probably never coming back.
Yeah. I think that The New Yorker is really apt in the way they describe the book as a rare depiction of belief that doesn't kill the thing it aspires to, that you make this space and then step away to let in the mystery. There are ways in which the book is constructed that sort of creates this alluring yet undefinable and untouchable space of mystery, I think. And one of them is that we seemingly get three points of view, but really they're all filtered through the recollection of one point of view, Will's. So even though we think we are in Phoebe's point of view, or sort of in Phoebe's point of view, we really are in Will's comprehension of Phoebe. And Will, I don't think, really understands himself that well, let alone his girlfriend. So there's a way in which the book and Will seems to be grasping towards something that is undefinable and maybe not unknowable, but at least it's not known. And I know that other interviewers have probed about the meaning of this setup. I think the setup's really effective because I feel like it doubles down on this question of faith and mystery and allowing the mystery to live. And some of these other interviewers, and I would include myself in this, thought there was a deeper meaning structurally to the story, that it's the story of a Korean American woman sort of ineffectually told by a white man's over. The framing is of the white man who's sort of inadequately able to tell the story. But it also seemed like in a lot of these conversations, that's not really something that was intentional, but maybe this was more through a process of trial and error and drafting around voice that you ended up with this structure. So I would love to hear, because it's really strange, this way in which we switch points of view, but we almost, in another sense, don't ever switch point of view.
Yeah, no, it very much was trial and error, because as you may have already have read, the book really did start with just Phoebe, and that was how I originally thought that the book was going to be told, by having her tell the whole story. And then I found that she just goes through so much. She loses so very much, and then she believes she gains a great deal. And the book felt very spiky to me when thought of that way. Just like too many ups and downs, ups and downs. And I found that letting someone who loved Phoebe but wasn't at the center of the action, letting someone else tell a lot of the story, just let more air into the room, let more air into the book. It changed, it expanded the repertoire of what kinds of registers I could hit and feel emotionally truthful about. But yeah.
And it strangely made it harder to know the characters and increased the desire to know the characters at the same time. There was this like sort of friction and tension that I thought was really productive. Mm. Kind of like I would imagine like wanting to know God and not ever being able to know God. Mm. So like I think Will is earnest in wanting to know Phoebe, and Phoebe and Will are both wanting to understand the cult, but the amount of understanding that is there feels like it's just beyond the page.
I love that so much. That's that's so great. Yeah, I have nothing to add except that I love that.
Speaking of this question of whiteness in the book, it's interesting to me that that Phoebe's friends call her the whitest Asian girl they've ever met, and that John Leal thinks this is a form of self-hatred.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, or I imagine that this must have been seductive to her, not just joining the group because of the other things that the group provides, but also as a means to reclaim something about herself or to reorient herself to a sense of identity. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if you could maybe speak to that a little bit.
I saw it myself, certainly. I didn't quite experience it myself because I had the strange good luck of growing up in a town that my high school was 80% Asian, roughly, and a majority of that was Korean. And so I grew up in a high school in which I'm Korean-American, was offered as an elective, a language elective. And people who weren't Korean took the Korean elective, in part because they wanted to understand, like, what people were saying when they were talking in Korean.
That's awesome.
During lunch, you know? And
did
so
they learn that in the class?
I think less so, maybe. But it just meant that I never had the experience, for instance, of like opening my lunchbox and as a kid and having people make fun of me because there was kimchi and Korean food, you know? And so I didn't grow up with that kind of shame about who I was. And then I went to college and I met so many people who did grow up with that kind of shame. And I went to college in a place where I started experiencing firsthand what it meant to be part of a minority group in America. And so, yeah, I think for Phoebe, I think you're absolutely right that it is very seductive to her that that John Leal is both seeing a kind of shame that she perhaps hasn't acknowledged, and showing her ways in which she shouldn't feel shame.
One of the other ways in which I feel like the story is naturally mysterious and creates space for this unknowableness is that we have the country North Korea as part of it, and I would like to hear about your decisions around North Korea, because obviously we all have sort of limited information, limited firsthand accounts at this point. So I was wondering how much research you did regarding North Korea and how much you wanted to leave it sort of in the space of the imagined or the unimagined.
Yeah, it was of the utmost importance to me that the book not try to make claims about North Korea as an entity. And yeah, I did do a lot of research, but it wasn't because I was thinking, oh, maybe I'll write about North Korea. It was just that I had a family history in North Korea. And I think I wanted to know about these distant family members who I knew nothing else about otherwise. And when North Korea started sort of making its way into the book, which is more how it felt, it was more that John Leal started taking on this North Korean past. I very much wanted to leave space around anything I said about North Korea and to sort of depict that unknowing itself, to depict that uncertainty itself. I didn't want anyone to walk away from this book thinking, okay, yeah, like, I really know a lot about North Korea now. I felt and feel that there are a lot of responsibilities that come with even fictionally depicting a place when there are so few depictions available outside of the country itself of the place.
Well, what sort of, if any, family stories did you grow up about North Korea?
So that's, I think that's part of why I went on the spree of reading about North Korea. No one ever really talked about it. It wasn't a thing. It was just that I had ancestors who had fled what's now North Korea, but of course then it was just one country, who had fled what's now North Korea before the start of the Korean War. And so there was just like a detachment and divide from all of it. But that meant that I have or had distant family members I've never met who were or are still there.
But was there, do you think that silence in your family was a taboo that wasn't approached, or was it just a lack of focus on that?
I'm not really sure. It's really, it's hard to tell. My, this is true of a lot of Korean families. My parents tend not to talk about the past. Even just the most basic questions like, why did we immigrate here? And they always say, well, it was for your education. And I know that that's true. And education's always been very important to them. But my entire family, including like every single one of my cousins, all my aunts and uncles, like we all moved here within something like a 10-year period. And it wasn't as though... Well, how to put this? It wasn't as though they were starving in South Korea or anything. My father had a lot of friends in Korea. He'd gone to school there. He was working at Hyundai. Like he had like a life. But they all uprooted themselves and came. And the only story I've ever heard is that it was just for our educations. But that I don't think is the entire. I don't think that's the only reason why, but I haven't heard otherwise.
Yeah.
And if I ask, they still say, oh, no, honey, it was for your education. Don't worry about it.
And is there's no anxiety about you investigating North Korea or putting it in the book from a family perspective necessarily?
No, not at all. They my family has very little, they both don't really talk about the past, and they don't really exhibit anxiety about it, which is really interesting to me. It's not as though I grew up feeling as though there was an abyss of pain that that they were shielding me from. But it does extend even so far as like my grandmother won't talk about the Korean War and what happened, and she'll just say, "Don't worry about it." Like it's not, you know, it was fine, and it's just like I've just like, I've read about the Korean War, like. Went down,
what's weird to me is in the culture at large, it doesn't feel like the Korean War even gets acknowledged as a war. Like I think of, you know, America will, I mean, if we think about films about Vietnam or films about World War II, it feels strange to me the absence of sort of a cultural or political or ethical engagement with that war even having happened.
Yeah.
There's not a silence around North Korea now, but I would imagine that most non-Korean Americans could say very little about what happened in the Korean War.
Yeah. And it's perhaps especially strange given that the U.S. still has a military presence in South Korea.
Could you tell us a little bit about the essay you wrote about the Olympics?
Sure. I just wrote that because I don't usually watch a lot of sports, but I tend to love watching the Olympics. I think there's something about these like short bursts of people's lifelong hopes being displayed on the screen that I find to be tremendously moving, and as a lot of people do. And I was trying to watch the Olympics this time around, and like almost as soon as I started trying, I started crying. And there was something about when they had the two Koreas come in together, it felt incredibly painful to see a sort of display of unity that that felt very different from the reality, especially then of the relationship between the two Koreas.
Did you also mention in the piece that terrible comment about Japan?
Oh God, yes. I think I touched on that. Oh my God, yeah. I've forgotten his name, but the person, the Olympics commentator, who said that. Oh God, I'm going to paraphrase, but whatever, it was awful. That South Korea really admires Japan and has learned a great deal from Japan and looks up to Japan or something. It was something along those lines. I mean, yeah. It was, from what I heard, it was front page news in Korea, and I believe the commentator was fired because what on earth? I mean, there's just like the sheer level of ignorance.
But I might argue that ignorance is really widespread. Like, I wonder. And maybe this touches back to something about that the Korean War and the circumstances of it, and then obviously Korean history before the war being not prominent in non-Koreans' minds in America. Like, I would imagine most Americans would have to go look why that was so terribly that they would have to go look to know why that was such a terrible comment to make.
And that could be the case, but I think part of what outraged so many people was that it was the commentator for that network on the Olympics taking place in Korea. So that was what was just so what was outrageous. Like, well, it wasn't the ignorance itself. It was just like, for heaven's sake, find someone who knows something, like just a tiny bit about. Could you not find a Korean American, for instance?
Yeah.
Could you not find a Korean American?
Well, the ignorance isn't defensible either, ultimately, I don't think.
Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to also touch on around North Korea is you set up a parallel, I think a structural parallel at the beginning of the book that you just touch on, but I thought it was interesting. You sort of characterized the belief system in North Korea as one sharing structural characteristics with that of faith in the opening pages. In speaking of John Leal in the Gulag, you say, punished for absurdities, they still maintained that the beloved sovereign, a divine being, could not be to blame. The refugees he'd met in Yanji talked of loving the god they'd fled. They attributed the regime's troubles to anyone but the sole person in charge. And in a way, it feels like that, while that's a description of their relationship to the beloved sovereign or the divine being leading North Korea, it also seems to implicate Christianity, because in the sense that you blame everyone but the sole being in charge. So in a sense, like, whatever is going on is not going to be, that's not going to be blamed on God or the divine being. I didn't know if that was an intentional nod to something. I don't know if it's totalitarian or something to do with certainty and faith, regardless of whether it's a secular faith or a religious one.
I wasn't implying much about Christianity itself in there. It was, given it's filtered through, well, given it's what John Leal, in theory, would have said for himself, it was John Leal's take on Christianity and John Leal's take on belief systems.
Well, I want to have you read another section. And partly the reason why I want you to read it is because it feels like, I'm curious about your writing education or your writing interests, actually, because after encountering one amazing sentence after another amazing sentence, and then reading interviews where you say things like, I love the roll and crunch of syllables in my mouth, and where you've recorded yourself reading the book out loud so that you can play it back and listen to the sounds, and how you've wanted to achieve what Susan Sontag called lexical inevitability, that every single line would feel as if it couldn't be any other way. It made me wonder, well, it mainly made me wonder whether you had a background in poetry. And if not, what your background was that that brought you to the sort of a love of the sentence in particular.
Yeah, thank you so much for saying that. That means a lot to me. I wrote a little poetry in high school, the way I think a lot of writers do, but I what I love reading most are, I mean, and I also love reading essay collections and story collections and poetry and all of it, but what I love reading most are novels. And I think to me, that was a clear indicator that that's what I wanted to write myself. But a lot of the writers I do love the most are such, I mean, I can read a whole book by Virginia Woolf or Mavis Gallant, and they, and every, almost every sentence feels so exactly right. And so I think that I think the writers I love are the ones who taught me or showed me what was possible.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit more about your relationship with Virginia Woolf before you read?
Sure.
Because you have this book you won't name that you're superstitious. You're superstitious about it. It's sort of like the patron. She's sort of the patron saint of this book in some respects.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. It's just, it was a book I reread every day for a few years, and while I was working on this book, and it, I would just like open it at random and read, you know, like a paragraph, maybe a page. Sometimes I would want a particular passage, and I started to get to know the book well enough that I could, just like open it without thinking, and I would find the passage.
Yeah.
And all, not all, but what it helped me do was it would just like help set the pitch for my writing day. It would help pull me back into my writing and into the world of my novel. I would read a paragraph and again just be astonished by something she'd done with an image or a turn that she'd achieved in a sentence. And the only reason I don't want to name it is because I'm just afraid that I don't know, that like she'll stop helping me. Not that I believe, I of course don't believe she's like real and out there, but I'm afraid that her work will stop helping me.
Yeah. I don't want you to name it either, though I kind of want you to whisper it away from the microphone. So do you want to introduce a section and maybe read a little bit so people can hear the prose?
Yeah, of course. Thank you. I'll just read the first chapter, which is a couple pages long. One will. They'd have gathered on a rooftop in Noxhurst to watch the explosion. Platt Hall, I think, 11 floors up. I know his ego, and he'd have picked the tallest point he could. So often, I've imagined how they felt, waiting. With 6 minutes left, the slant light of dusk reddened the high old spires of the college, the level gables of its surrounding town. They poured festive wine into big-bellied glasses. Handshaking, they laughed. She would sit apart from this reveling group, cross-legged on the roof's west ledge. 3 minutes to go. 2. 1. The Phipps building fell. Smoke plumed the breath of God. Silence followed, then the group's shouts of triumph. Wine glasses clashed together, flashing martial light. He sang the first bars of a Cheja psalm. Others soon joined in. Carillon bells chimed, distant birds blowing white, strewn, like dandelion tufts, an outsized wish. It must have been then that John Leal came to her side. In his bare feet, he closed his arm around her shoulders. She flinched, looking up at him. I can imagine how he'd have tightened his hold, telling her she'd done well, though before long it would be time to act again, to do a little more. But this is where I start having trouble, Phoebe. Buildings fell. People died. You once told me I hadn't even tried to understand. So here I am, trying.
I've been listening to R.O. Kwan read from The Incendiaries. So it isn't uncommon for writers on their first book to spend a long time making their first book. I've had many debut writers say that it's taken 10 years to write their first book. But one of the reasons why yours took a long time, you've said, is that you believe the first 20 pages had to be a perfect foundation, and that you would then spend long periods of time working and reworking the sentences so that you'd have the right foundation when you move forward. So I was wanting you to unpack what you now consider false assumptions in that for us, if you could.
Yeah, of course. Those were a tricky first couple of years of the book. It's what I realized was, so at the end of those 2 years, I had 20 pages that had been obsessively reworked. And it just felt so dead. Like, it felt so inert. I'd never read such inert prose in my entire life, is how I felt. And I realized that I had been reworking these 20 pages without having much of an understanding of what would come next. And so it was the worst possible foundation for a book, because it was this, in what had become a very inflexible, compact thing that didn't, I couldn't really go from there to anything else. So I just threw it away and I started all over again.
You threw it away.
With more or less the same characters, yeah.
So you've also said that you got hung up on metaphor, and that metaphor can be quite dangerous. And I wasn't entirely sure what you meant, though I'm compelled by it.
I got really sold on the idea of a metaphor that I was only telling myself, that you can't build, you can't have a building without a foundation, and the foundation has to be solid. But this was the worst possible metaphor, because how do you build a foundation if you don't know what the rest of the building will look like? So it could be, you know, it could be a one bedroom apartment in a city, or it could be an opera house, and these are very different foundations. I was just like I was very convinced by my own metaphor. I just kept walking around muttering about foundations anytime anyone asked why I was spending so long on those first 20 pages.
Well, I would really love to maybe do a little deep dive into the various ways you've prevented yourself from obsessing on sentences at the beginning so that you can move forward. So you've mentioned Lauren Groff as someone who is pivotal in sort of breaking you out of this pattern.
Yeah.
So maybe you could tell us a little bit about some of the strategies you use now, so that you don't get stuck on making sure everything's perfect before you write the next thing.
Yeah, of course. So she said, because I met her right around that two-year mark at a writer's conference, and she mentioned that she tends to spin through a few drafts by hand, writing as fast as she can. And she doesn't even reread. She doesn't even read them. She just throws them away and moves on. So I tried doing that, but I would read that. I would read them, and I would pull out the parts that felt alive to me, that felt interesting to me, and put them into a document, and then try again. After I did that a few times, I moved on to trying to write as fast as I could on a computer. I use an app or a program for my computer that turned my computer into a typewriter, so I could only backspace one letter at a time.
And what does that achieve?
It means that if I can only backspace one letter, and then I have to move forward again, it means I can't go back and copy and paste. I can't delete things. It just forces you to march forward, more or less. All it lets you correct really is typos. And so that was helpful.
What's that program called?
It was called Typewriter, but I think it's gone. But I think there are other typewriters now that replicate that. I turned the font white as I went. So as soon as I finished a paragraph, I would turn it white. So I just like to prevent myself from looking back. What I love now, this is almost always how I draft anything now. I'll write like 4-6 words at a time and then press enter and then just keep going down the page. And so it looks like a very ragged, sad, messy, epic poem. It's not. It's just that it's prose. It's just broken up so that I just visually cannot look at it and as easily figure out what the sentence is doing.
And then what about your feelings about Times New Roman versus Garamond?
I got so emphatic about this in another interview with the Chicago Review of Books that they published the interview with the headline. I think the headline was, R. O. Kuan does not trust Garamond, and neither should you. I used to write in Garamond because it is so, it's so pretty. It's so, it makes everything look so nice. And I realized that it was lying to me. I would look at a sentence and in Garamond, and then I'd look at it in another font and realize that it was a much worse sentence than I thought, and Garamond had been dressing it up. And so I love writing in Times New Roman because it is just this like trustworthy, quite ugly font. It doesn't hide flaws the way Garamond does.
But you won't use Comic Sans?
I won't use Comic Sans. Somebody told me that they use Comic Sans, and I was just like, good God almighty. Who has that kind of strength of soul, too?
It would require a certain strength.
It does. Everything looks trivial in Comic Sans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of having the strength of soul, there was something that Laura Vanderberg said that I thought was interesting. She asked you about, when she was interviewing you, she asked you about faith and relationship to the act of writing, how writing, particularly something of novel length, requires an act of faith. How do you keep going? How do you push through hopelessness? How do you sit in the uncertainty of unfinishedness? So I was wondering if maybe you could talk about faith and relationship to some of these questions that she posed and now I'm posing.
Yeah. No, that's such a great question. I think the less time I spend worrying about larger questions like, is this book going anywhere? Do I know what I'm doing? What am I doing with my life? Why didn't I become a dermatologist? It's a question that became at some point a running joke in my household. My husband would come home and I would just be dejected and I'd just be like, the writing day was terrible. I don't know what I'm doing. How have I been working on this book for so long? Why didn't I become a dermatologist? And he would ask, are we on that dermatologist question again?
Yeah.
But I think the less time I spend wondering about these gigantic questions and the more time I spend on the page in a scene wondering, what's this next line going to do? What about the previous line? How do these two lines work together? What are the syllables doing? The better off I am.
And what's remarkable about that, I think, also is that you've said that in the 10 years you worked every day on the book.
Pretty much, yeah, pretty much. I think there were a few exceptions, but I tried very hard to work every day. I just find that for me, and I know people vary in their approaches, but for me, I'm my writing's going better if I'm writing every day.
I think it was you who quoted Dean Young, who says, you have to sweep the temple steps a lot in hopes that God appears.
Yeah.
Was that?
Yeah, it was definitely Dean Young. I don't remember the exact line, but yeah, yes.
Yeah.
I love quoting him.
So to return to the book itself, one of the major things we haven't talked about yet is about terrorism and faith, a question that is central to the book. And you've pushed back against the automatic response that we tend to have to these acts when people use language of incomprehension, when people say, how could a person do this? This is unimaginable. These people aren't people but monsters.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about your desire to complicate or reject that sort of response to people who are doing acts of terrorism in the name of a faith or an ideology.
I think in part because I'm so different from the God-crazed girl I was for a while. I was fascinated while writing this book, and I remain fascinated by the varieties, by how different people's definitions of good and of right can be. And of course, we see this playing out every day in utterly heartbreaking ways in the news. And it remains fascinating to me. And it's not that I've come to any real answers, but the questions remain fascinating to me of how one person can define something as being good that other people can define as being just utterly evil and vice versa.
Well, it was refreshing to see a book that was looking at terrorism and faith and wasn't looking at Islam and terrorism, which is sort of the reflexive way that Americans would twin the two, because we rarely would call Christian acts or Jewish acts of terrorism. Mm-hmm. We'd call them something else in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if, was there any pushback in among the Christian community that you grew up in to name it in that way?
I haven't come across any pushback. I mean, knock on wood. I think if anything, people who are Christian who have read the book, a lot of people have said that they appreciate the ways in which Christianity itself and belief itself are not at all vilified or simplified.
Yeah.
I do also get occasional emails from people proselytizing to me, which I find to be a little,
wow.
a little, I'm more, my response to that is more, or rather I tend not to respond, but when people do, when I do receive emails like that, I'm just like, well, you know, you'll have to get in line because my mother's been praying for me every day since I lost the faith.
But. You don't hit spam on those emails?
I put them in a folder.
Well, I guess I wonder if part of, you know, the automatic response to not be able to comprehend these acts, and then this time period of your life when you felt very certain about things, if there's a certain way of relating to certainty, and there's a way in which you can say, well, it is comprehensible if you felt certain about these things, like that can lead to any number of things. Like you've quoted Eric Hoffer, the political philosopher, who said, to be in possession of an absolute truth is to have a net of familiarity spread over the whole of eternity. And then you also quoted Julio Cortazar, who said, I've remained on the side of the questions, which I feels like where you are now, on the side of the questions. I would love for you to talk a little bit about your aversion to certainty now, like the way that it's something that makes you even afraid.
Yeah.
And it was something that brought you a lot of solace.
Yeah, I think I am deeply allergic to certainty. And I'm allergic to it so much that I think I'm still open to the idea that maybe my allergy to certainty itself isn't correct. I think that a lot of harm has been done in the world by people who are certain they are right. And that at least in the books I read and the people I love, a lot of the people who, I think that being open to the idea that one may not be in possession of absolute truths is a less harmful way to go through the world, to move through the world. But I'm not sure about that.
Well, did you ever go through a period, it sounds like maybe you didn't, but did you ever go through a period where you were into like the Christian existentialist philosophers, the ones who like Paul Tillich, who were like, doubt is a prerequisite and even a part of faith? Like if you don't have doubt, that's not faith.
Yeah. I mean, I read them. I think I gained, well, I feel as though there are ways in which, like Simone Veil is her writing is shot through with doubt and questions. I did read them. I'm not sure that they stayed with me very much.
And how was you've mentioned that you visited a church accused of being a cult as part of the research for the incendiaries. So now that you're, you know, for a long time you've been on the side of the questions, how was that? Was that hard to do? How did that go?
While I was researching this book, I visited a church in the Bay Area just a couple of times that had been accused of being a cult. It's still running, you know, but anytime I go to a Christian service, that was true of this particular church too. I just feel such longing. Like I feel such longing and I feel such sadness it's like coming back to something that I miss very much, and a being I miss very much.
Are there misconceptions, do you think, about the type of people who end up in churches accused of being cults? In terms of, I would imagine that many people would just presume that people are naive or ignorant when maybe it's not that.
Yeah, that's a really lovely question. I think that maybe people believe, well, I really do. I don't like making generalizations. I think that's part of what I love about fiction is its adherence to the specific. But I think perhaps people are more susceptible to cults and to demagogues in general, as we can see in America in 2018 than they believe they themselves to be. Mm-hmm. And that certainty is incredibly appealing in ways that not everyone necessarily recognizes.
Yeah, they don't recognize the cults that they're in right now. Well, it was great having you on Between the Covers today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
We are talking today to Aro Kwan about her debut novel, The Incendiaries. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 11:59. It is time for the KBOO News at Noon for Thursday, November 15th, 2018. Donald Trump went on another tirade on Twitter this morning, apparently blurting out his desire to obstruct justice in the Mueller investigation of possible Russian interference in the 2016 election. Trump attacked Mueller and the FBI in a number of tweets earlier today. According to CNN, Mueller has already begun writing his final report, even as it looks like more indictments are coming. This comes a day after Mueller's office announced that they are exploring whether Roger Stone, a longtime Trump advisor, tried to intimidate a witness. And a federal judge on Thursday refused a request by a Russian company to dismiss the criminal charges brought against it by special counsel Robert Mueller. The company, Concord Inc., is accused of funding a propaganda operation to sway the 2016 presidential election in Donald Trump's favor. In California, the Camp Fire near Chico has grown to 140,000 acres and is now 40% contained. As of Wednesday evening, the death toll had reached 56, making the Camp Fire California's deadliest ever. The blaze, now in its eighth day, has also destroyed over 8,800 structures. But PG&E, a major gas and power company in California, might have been able to prevent or at least mitigate some of that damage. PG&E had originally alerted about 70,000 residents that it planned to turn off power to prevent downed power lines from sparking, but it never did. On Tuesday, a coalition of lawyers filed a lawsuit accusing PG&E of negligence when the fire conditions worsened. Under California law, even if a utility does everything possible to prevent a fire, if its equipment caused the blaze, the company can be held accountable. PG&E, which said it's fully cooperating with all ongoing state investigations into the Camp Fire, is already expected